Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, author James M. Bradley talks about his biography, Martin Van Buren, America's First Politician. It was published by Oxford University Press in December 2024. And in June of this year, James Bradley was interviewed at BIO's annual conference in Washington, D.C., at the National Press Club by BIO member Simon Reed.
James, great to be here with you at the National Press Club talking in person at the 2025 BIO Conference. Love the Van Buren book. Let's dive in. You call Van Buren America's first politician. I know he's the first president who's born not a British subject, but what do you mean by he's America's first politician, and how does he differ from the founding fathers? Because they were political figures, correct?
They were very much political figures, but Van Buren was more open about it. He really felt like if we are going to be in this profession of politics, then we need to be good at it. We need to be professionals. We can't just be clever come around election time. We need to create some sort of entity that will both help elect people like us to power and connect to the voters. So he saw political parties not as a necessary evil that you had to do to win something at election time, but he saw it really as an intrinsic part of government. He even said that in his autobiography. He just said, free parties are inseparable from free governments. He really thought these two were connected. So he was the first to argue this, I think, and he was the first to create the mass political parties. Now, there were political parties before he came to power. There were the Federalists and there were the Republicans or the Democratic Republicans. See, that's another thing that confuses people. The nomenclature was so up in the air. When Van Buren comes along, he doesn't want it to be just sort of a name or a label. He wanted to be something like a real living, breathing entity. So it was more like a party that would have conventions and rallies, and the idea of a candidate is someone you have to present to the voters and give him an image and a personality. So really, when we think about politics today, the image of politics in the public mind, you can really trace all of this to Martin Van Buren in the 1820s and the 1830s when he, I think, you know, revolutionized politics in unprecedented ways.
And so he's obviously had a lasting impact. What do you think he'd make of the party system as it is today?
He would be crying into his Dutch beer.
He was the son of a tavern.
He was the son of a tavern keeper. Yeah. You know, in some ways he would be impressed because, I mean, when you look at the cohesion, especially in today's Republican Party, where you will see very few defections against the president right now, I think in some respects Van Buren would tip his hat to that. He says, wow, I don't know how you did this. I wish I could have had this sort of loyalty from my own party, but at the same time, he very much believed that there should be a tier to this political system, and he just thought the states and the House of Representatives, this is where you have the rancor and the fighting, and this is where you have these real drawn-out arguments about policy and ideology and things like that. And but then things are supposed to move on to the Senate, which is where he sat for almost a decade. And the Senate is where the grown-ups sit down and hammer out an agreement. Now, the Senate is every bit as crazy as the House, excuse me. And, of course, the president is a different matter altogether. But certainly there's a lot about today's politics he would not like. The role of money, the level of rancor. It's something that was completely anathema to his particular vision about how parties should work with government.
This is the first Van Buren biography in, I think, 40 years?
Well, the first, yes. I mean, there have been smaller books, and there have been books written about aspects of his life, but in terms of the more
comprehensive
like cradle to grave, this is the first one, in 40 years.
So what drew you to Van Buren as a subject? He's not a household name. I mean, he's had a massive impact on the American political system. I mean, he's sort of the father of what we have today. So what drew you to him as a subject, and are you frustrated by his lack of name recognition? Should more people know about this guy?
Well, I think people should know more about him. It's an interesting life, and by studying his life, you almost learn about the entire early republic, because he's born in December of 1782. He's born at the very birth of the American Republic. He dies in July of 1862, and the nation is ripped apart over the Civil War. So by studying his life, you really get to study the whole panorama of U.S. history from this period. As to what drew me to him, I wish I knew. Believe me, there were days where I asked myself that when I was struggling with the material. He was always a fascinating guy to me, and I was always struck by how I would see his name in a lot of books about the period. Some of the more general history books would have a lot of devotion to Van Buren and his role in the party system. But biographies, though, seem to be not as much, and I think that's got something to do with his historical reputation. And he's been kind of lumped in with these antebellum one-term presidents with mutton chops.
Right.
I remember a publisher turning me down saying, "We don't do mutton chops." That was something. So one term, antebellum president. He was considered one of these losers who sort of didn't stop the nation's descent into civil war. So it's because of that, it's kind of a hard sell to get people interested in his life. But I think once they do, they see it's pretty rich, fascinating life.
And you talk about like this reputation of him being sort of like a loser and mutton chops. I mean, he was a very sharp man, wasn't he? I mean,
yes.
This guy was a sharp political operator. When did you first sort of become aware of Van Buren? What drew your attention to him? Did you read something in a book and just immediately go, "That's an interesting guy I want to know more about"? When did you first become aware
of him? Arthur Schlesinger's The Age of Jackson, which was written in 1945, but it was still read in the 1980s when I was a student. And I read it, and the book is dated in many ways. It's got some terrible omissions. He devotes one sentence to the Indian Removal Act. But at the same time, it's a really gripping narrative. And that's what got me interested in this period. And there's another Van Buren biographer, Donald Cole, who I think died in 2014. I had an email exchange with him not long before he died, and he said the same thing to me. He said, "I read Arthur Schlesinger's book." So it's remarkable how this book, and not just Van Buren biographers, but Sean Wilentz and other historians have said what a formative impact this book had on them. So kudos to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. He left a great impact.
Obviously. You mentioned the Indian removal. When we talk about Van Buren's presidency, one term, and his presidency is kind of overshadowed by two things. It's the financial panic of 1837, which I think happens. It kicks in like a month or so after he's sworn in.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, he oversees the Trail of Tears and Andrew Jackson's Indian removal. He gets a bad rep for those. They're not necessarily his doing, because the Indian removal that he oversees is the result of Jackson's policies, but he doesn't sort of do anything to stop it. How should his presidency be remembered?
Should be remembered as a cautionary tale on a number of fronts. One has got to do with the compromises he made up until that point that were all done in the name of getting him elected. And
compromises on slavery.
Compromises on slavery. He really played the race card in 1835, 1836. This is when slavery was really becoming more of a political issue on a national scale. And people were saying to him, "You're a Northerner, and the South is never going to vote for you. It doesn't matter that you've pledged to never interfere with slavery. The fact that you're a Northerner is going to alienate a lot of Southerners. So you've got to prove that you will fight against this." So there was a riot at a church in Utica when there was an abolitionist society tried to meet there in 1835, and he ordered his people to really break this up. So you see things like this, all these compromises that he made and these positions that he took. Now, as for the Indian Removal Act, that was law, and that law was settled from Andrew Jackson in 1830. Nevertheless, there was a really brutal nature, the way the Cherokees were removed from Georgia. And that's on him, because it didn't have to be done this way. You read the stories about how they were just completely driven out of this territory and how they were transported across the country and how thousands have died from disease and some were killed outright. It's just a horrific story. So the way this was carried out, of course, is a great stain on his record. And finally, in terms of the panic of 1837, he was in a political bind when he becomes president, because Jackson's policies in many ways brought this about. And I think he knew this deep down. He didn't like Jackson. Jackson had this thing about paper money. You know, it's a great irony that his face is on the $20 bill, because he thought paper money was just this great scourge, and he just thought everything should be done in specie and coin, to the point where he wanted to sign an executive order, which was, if you want to buy federal lands, you have to buy it with coin. That shows you how cheap the land were back then. So when he becomes president, banks are practically drained of all their specie. And on top of that, there's a transatlantic recession going on with Great Britain. So they start to recall their loans, and banks can't pay them because they don't have any money. So the compromises you make to get to the top, they will come back to haunt you. I mean, this is an old story, but it really becomes prominent in his presidency. And he's just not equipped to deal with these things.
Right.
Yeah.
So you read Schlesinger's book on Jackson, you get this fascination for Van Buren, and now you decide to write a biography, and this is your first biography.
It is.
And your subject wrote an autobiography himself, 800 pages.
That's right, and I read the whole thing.
And he doesn't really reveal much about himself. His father's relegated to one sentence.
Pretty much, yeah.
He doesn't mention his wife.
No.
This is a guy who sort of straddles the moral gray area. He straddles the both sides of an issue.
And don't forget his children. He hardly mentions them.
He hardly mentions his
passing references here and there, yeah.
Yeah, he's not like a doting family man. Like, as a first-time biographer, how do you tackle someone like this who is kind of evasive and hard to nail down? And was there a point when you started researching this going, oh, my God, what have I done?
Every day, pretty much. You know, reading between the lines is something that all historians must do. You have to be careful. You don't want to go too far. At the same time, when you have people like this who are guarded in their correspondence, guarded in many ways about their life, didn't reveal very much about his inner life. But if you stick with it, things will start to come out.
Right.
So it's just a matter of perseverance, really, like everything else in this profession.
I think it was 14,000 letters you had access to, Van Buren.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you even begin? You have access to the archives.
Well, luckily, I have a lot of help there. Yeah. I'm the co-editor of the Martin Van Buren Papers. Right. We have a staff of scholars and professionals and people who are involved on the tech end of things. And we're involved in the collecting and annotating and so that organization helps, so you can look up a subject and get everything. So we are trying to take this unwieldy mass of documents and trying to put it all together in a website, and we're going to hopefully have some letterpress editions coming out soon. For people who like to deal with print, they'll have that option as well. But certainly the digital option helps you with research, because you can just look for how many times did Van Buren use the word scoundrel in a letter. Well, I can find out. Just go into this text search bar, type in scoundrel, boom, there it is. So it's a helpful way to do these things.
And for a man who did not reveal much of himself in his 800-page autobiography, but you do have access to all these letters, you know, like I said, 14,000, anything in there that you found surprising? I mean, did you learn anything new about him writing this book that you didn't know before? Or did everything were you kind of anticipating everything you stumbled across?
Well, there were new things all the time. You know, he had a couple of close friends. And with these friends, you would see his more playful side. Mm-hmm. And that always caught me by surprise. I'd read a letter and say, oh, wait, he's making a joke.
Hey, mutton chops has a sense of humor.
I'm thinking, well, what's he talking about? And then it would hit me. That's a joke he's making. So those discoveries show that
he was human.
He was human, and he could laugh at himself. I mean, he was not known as a great wit. He wasn't Benjamin Franklin or anything like that, but he had a few clever remarks, over the years. So he would occasionally
let loose.
Let out a rib tickler once in a while.
What amazes me about the book is it's a political biography, and yet it's not dry. And my apologies to people who write political biographies, for instance, but it's not dry. It moves with a real momentum. And you're dealing with a guy here with, his political resume is massive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dense. Yeah. How do you make politics a page turner? Because the book does have a real narrative momentum, and it reads really easily. I mean, was that just a happy accident? Did you have to concentrate on that? I mean, how did you balance momentum with historical accuracy with all this?
He lived during exciting times.
Yeah.
That needs to be said. I think the key for these things is trying to find that right balance to give the reader enough information, but not to overwhelm them. That's when things can get kind of stuck. So you need to step back a little bit and try to find that right balance between quotes and other kinds of information that you can give to really propel the narrative along. But when you have a man whose life, professional career, really begins with the War of 1812, and there he is, you know, up until the end and during the Civil War, that's quite a sweep and panorama to his life right there. So you're already dealing with a lot of great material.
We've talked about he was a very complicated person. When you're writing the book, did you find it hard to remain objective when dealing with some of his more morally shady decisions?
You know, slavery is, I think, the hardest subject for any historian to write about, because you're writing about one of the great crimes in human history. Right. You're writing about misery on an epic scale. So how do you do that and at the same time talk about his political considerations and how he's trying to keep his coalition in place? You feel like you're compromised right away doing that. Again, we go back to what we said earlier about the balancing act. You need to talk about the consequences of their decisions, but at the same time show that he was a politician trying to hold it together without making excuses or trying to apologize for him. Right. Yep.
Researching a figure who lived, you know, a couple hundred years ago, always a challenge just because of the existence of material or records. I mean, what do you think is the biggest challenge in writing the biography of someone who existed, you know, who operated in the 19th century? Because is it hard to get a sense of their personality without being able to see a video of them or hear a recording of them talking? I mean, how do you get a sense of them just based on letters left behind and a vague autobiography?
Yeah, and it's not just him, but his relationship with his wife, his relationship with his sons. There's stuff there. You have to really make do with what you have. Mm. And if you search, you know, you'll usually find enough material that it will at least form a picture. And once you get that picture, you can start to write. So yes, it was a long time ago. At the same time, though, there's enough there. I never felt like I don't have enough here to form a picture. The real struggle was his early life. I'm talking about his childhood, things like that. And that's where I had to rely on some outside material about life in the Hudson Valley in the late 18th century. So that's where I had to rely on other sources. And then you see the picture come together about how all of this affected his life.
So when you were writing the biography, did you feel you felt like you had a good sort of sense of him, not just as like a politician, but as a human being?
The human being, there's always going to be a bit of a mystery there to me. Right. And, people who write about figures who lived 180, 200 years ago will tell you the same thing. Because we look at today's politicians and they reveal so much about themselves. And now they're
too
on
much.
Too much. Now they're on social media. And, there's barely any part of their lives we don't know. And even though Van Buren, I think, was more open about his intentions than others were from that period, there was still the thing about his personal life and his inner life where he kept his distance from others. But again, when you look through the material enough, when you read these letters, and I don't just read them, remember, as my job as an editor of the Van Buren papers, I annotate them. And when
you're immersed in them.
You are examining letters on the granular level because you're looking at not just transcribing it, but he makes a reference to a specific event. Yeah. Well, what is that event? You have to look that up. Right. And then you go, that opens up a whole new territory for you.
Because this guy is the sort of the father of the American political system we have in place today. Did it change your views on American democracy or make you view our democracy in a different kind of way?
We like to think of democracy as something that expands with time, because in Van Buren's day, it was white male property owners were the only ones who could vote. At the same time, though, there were many ways we were more democratic, though, paradoxically. When I would hear about these town meetings, when people would get together and they would, a town would meet once a year and they would decide about local taxes and what that money should be used for, it's a lot more democratic than we have today. And then there was this business with the Erie Canal in the 1815, 1816 period, where people were sending what they called memorials. It's like a petition. It's like, we, the citizens of Buffalo, New York, would love a canal here. And people would sign it, and they'd have all these series of meetings. And there was a lot of opposition to the Erie Canal. But once these memorials started coming in, they all just kind of said, we can't ignore this. The people clearly want this, and they changed their positions. So in some respects, we were more democratic than we are today, where people, I feel like, are more removed from the democratic process than ever.
I don't want to give away like the whole name of the book, but he's led this amazing life holding like every sort of political position you can imagine, but he's not really sort of satisfied with his sort of achievements, the life he's led at the end. Is he sort of a cautionary tale about politics without principle, or like how do you think he should be viewed, and what do you think like modern day politicians should sort of take away from Van Buren's story?
That's a loaded question, Simon. The cautionary tale has got to do with when you have issues that are grave, the idea that you can just sort of push them aside, the way they kept doing this with slavery, with a new compromise, kick the can down the road for 10 more years. That never works. Right. And we've got tremendous challenges facing us right now. I'm not even sure we're kicking the can down the road. We don't seem to be addressing them at all. So this idea that you can put these things aside, but for now, let's get elected, didn't work then. It's not going to work now. That's the alarming aspect of his life that today's public officials would be wise to consider. As to the overall impact, look, political parties are now what I call the principal engine for political expression in the United States right now. It's like politics and parties are inseparable. Anybody's running for office, you want to know right away, which team are you on?
Right.
In many ways, this was the world that Van Buren wanted. It's not the world the founding fathers wanted. Right. Quite the opposite. They really had this romantic notion that men of honor would be called to lead, and they would think in the national interest only, not in the interest of their parties. And now we are
what
as far
would they
removed
think today.
Right. And now we are as far removed from that as can be. Yeah. So in a way you could say it's Van Buren's world, we're just living in it.
This was your first biography. It's an immense subject to tackle. What's your biggest takeaway lesson in terms of writing a biography? What did you walk away from this book with that you can apply, do you think, to your next subject?
It's important to just focus on your next sentence, because when you're writing it and you think, oh, I have so much more to go, and you think of all the work you've done and you're already exhausted, and then you think, oh, I haven't even gotten into his post-presidency yet, it can really get overwhelming.
Right.
But when you look at your next sentence and then the sentence after that, before you know it, it starts to come together. Before you know it, you've got a chapter done. And that is a great feeling. Ah, all right, this chapter's done. Bring on the next one.
Great advice. James, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Thank
you,
Simon.
It's a fantastic book.
Thank
you. Love it. It's great. Everyone read it.
Thank you.
That was James M. Bradley speaking with bio member Simon Reed about his book, Martin Van Buren, America's First Politician. It was published by Oxford University Press in December 2024, and this interview was recorded in June of this year at Bio's annual conference in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.